From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, after the grid failed, who or what is to blame? Will Texas political leaders do what's necessary, or will special interest still hold sway?
People died, and people were without power, and people suffered for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks going on now, and it can't happen again. And we can't look just to the free market to call the winners and the losers.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. One of the interesting timing issues of the winter storm that gripped Texas starting on Valentine's Day and lasted almost a week is that this all happened in the early days of the legislative session. There would be no time buffering out this Texas disaster. And on Thursday, state lawmakers held hearings looking for answers as to why did Texans suffer one of the largest blackouts in the nation's history. They wanted to know who was picking this banjo. The head of the state's power grid operator was in the hot seat defending why the Electric Reliability Council of Texas ordered widespread blackouts. It was to keep the state's grid from collapsing. While demand for power skyrocketed, the supply of energy plummeted. ERCOT CEO Bill Magnus was asked by Democratic State Senator John Whitmire of Houston if he had any regrets about ERCOT's response.
You wouldn't have changed anything in terms of your play calling during those critical hours?
As I sit here now, I don't believe I would.
No regrets withstanding, six members of ERCOT's board of directors resigned after the grid's failure. Whitmire questioned whether the shortage of natural gas, which shut down some power plants, was actually due to frozen pipelines.
In fact, I've heard from reliable sources that the gas producers endured the shortages because it raised the prices while people were suffering, of course.
In the joint House committee hearing, energy executives told lawmakers that they have learned from last week's failures and that this type of crisis can be prevented in the future. They say the legislature has a crucial role to play in making the state's power grid and infrastructure more resilient. Mauricio Gutierrez is the CEO of NRG.
I think there is an opportunity by the legislature to define what is reliability, what is resilience, what is the standard that we need to have given the more extreme weather that we're seeing due to climate change.
Gutierrez says then state agencies can ensure that those standards are met. For a deeper understanding of what went wrong with the grid and how the problems are being addressed, I'm joined by Krista Castaneda, an energy attorney and engineer and a former Democratic candidate for Texas Railroad Commission. She watched the hearings this week, and she said it seemed like it was an earnest attempt to get to the root of this problem.
People were extremely alarmed about what had happened. I mean, every witness, all of the legislators really seemed shaken by what had gone on and seemed very motivated to try to find a way to fix it so it didn't happen again the next time.
What about evaluating what went wrong? Was there someone who really stepped up and said, it's my responsibility, buck stops here, I could have done better, but I didn't?
Well, almost everybody, with the possible exception of the PUC chairman and a little bit the ERCOT chairman, did that. I listened to the utility providers, the generators, all talk about what had gone wrong. I listened to the solar and wind trade associations talk about what went wrong, and everybody seemed to agree that they each had a part in the failure and that they could do better. Let me say, it seems like there were a few main root causes, although it's going to be months before we know exactly what happened. But as everybody has probably seen or read, the grid lost about half of its capacity precipitously on the morning of February 15th. And that's what caused everybody to be thrown off the grid in that, quote, load shed event. And that capacity loss seems to be due in large part to the generation facilities that use natural gas not being able to get adequate pressures coming off the pipelines that would supply them. there seems to have been a delivery failure further on upstream from those plants, and they don't really understand the full cause of what caused those natural gas supplies to not be delivered to the plants. But that was something people kept pointing to over and over again, is the pipelines were just not delivering the pressures and the supplies that they needed to keep running.
Consumers, of course, they want to know why they were left in the dark and why they were frozen and why their faith in the system has been shattered. But right now, their top concern is they're wondering, what kind of bill am I going to get? How much is it going to cost me to have been to be miserable for so long? What advice right now do you have for a consumer?
Well, good news is that the governor has suspended the utilities from sending electric bills and from cutting people off the grid, and is requiring them to work out payment plans with people, and also to remind people that they do not have to auto pay. So we don't know how long those things are going to last. I do think there's going to be some relief for consumers here, hopefully pretty urgently. But what I would say is, don't panic. Make sure you go on and understand your plan. You can get onto your provider's website and they will tell you what you're being charged and how you're being charged. Likely you're not being charged the wholesale prices unless you have one of those rare wholesale price plans. And the testimony is that only about 1% of consumers have those. But gather up your facts and figures. Don't panic, and try to work with your provider to arrange a payment plan if you can't make your payments all at once.
And that testimony said that there's a lot of people behind that 1%. So people who got into a plan in the deregulated market, which under best of circumstances, they were able to get a good price for their electricity, but when things go bad, they don't. These people tend to be some of the most vulnerable that we have in our system, and being told, yo, we'll give you a payment plan for what, a bill that's going to be in the thousands of dollars. That's still money that they don't have. And then maybe they shouldn't have to pay.
Yeah. And for those people, I do think that there's probably going to be some kind of relief. I don't know that even in those contexts, for those wholesale power plan customers, that the operators who use those are going to be allowed to pass along the full cost of the wholesale electricity. I think there's probably pretty robust support for that not happening.
So I probably don't have a full nuanced view that's required for understanding what happened during the big freeze in Texas when it came to the price of natural gas. So help me understand it. The Public Utility Commission on the 15th had an emergency meeting in which they were able to go into something like a scarcity pricing, and that allowed the natural gas providers we saw 16,000% increase for the cost of natural gas in Texas. And that was done in order to incentivize the natural gas providers to produce more. So did that happen?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Okay,
so the Public Utility Commission issued the order that you referenced, and what that did was allow for the transmission companies that run the grid to raise the bid price for a megawatt of electricity. And so it had the maximum bid price had been at $1,200, and they set it to $9,000 so that more capacity would be supplied. So when you raise the price at which something can be sold, then you expect that suppliers are going to jump into the market and provide more of that thing. That was the idea there. The problem was the electric generation companies weren't able to come back online with that capacity. We now know that it was a couple of days before they were able to get restarted. So that pricing mechanism, that PUC order, appears not to have really done very much. What you're talking about on the supply side for natural gas, so way back up from the power plants where, at the wellheads and the pipelines where the natural gas is being supplied to those generation companies, that the spot price of natural gas went from about a little under $3 the week before to $180 an MMBTU. So the price of natural gas rose enormously. And the companies, the generation companies that were having to buy supply on the spot market were exposed to that huge market upswing. And the thinking was, and still may be true for some of the smaller players, that that cost of obtaining natural gas was keeping them from generating the capacity that we needed. We did hear from NRG and Vistra yesterday that market dynamic didn't keep them from getting enough supply, but the physical problems kept them from getting supply.
The expression that we're incentivizing these companies to take action, I would think that having Texans freezing to death in their own homes would be enough of an incentive. And the fact that they were going to, you know, that we weren't asking them to provide these products for free. They were being well compensated for this, but to allow the price to reach such astronomic levels, this market has flaws.
Oh, it clearly does. And really yesterday, we didn't really have the legislature get into all of those financial problems. But there are many, many financial problems with what happened here, including the fact that really all the profits got taken by people who were speculating in natural gas on the supply side. And those, the way our electric grid works is that the people who generate electricity really rely on a few days a year to turn a profit. And this would have been one of those times, but instead they are holding a loss, and that profit that they would make is the money that they would use to invest in more into their own businesses of generating electricity that we can rely on. So there's a whole discussion that's got to be had about the financial consequences of this deregulated market, and we can't have the winners and the losers being sorted out by what just happened.
There was a point made that when we call ERCOT reliability, so what is reliability? What do we consider that to be? For how much extra capacity should our system have in order to have a reliable energy grid?
Right. That is the question. That is absolutely the question. As I understand it, and I'm not an expert on electricity generation or the capacity issues, but the major players who were there testifying yesterday, and that was Vistra and NRG, and there are others, but they were the ones who were there, said that they voluntarily maintain excess capacity over what their allotment for the grid supply is. So if they're supplying 20%, then that's their allotment of what they're normally supplying. They would maintain, let's say, 23 or 24% as capacity in case it needs to be called up. But that's not true across the grid, and there's no balancing of capacity, an excess reserve capacity across the grid.
So moving forward, if they order or require that there's going to be excess capacity needed for Texas, what would that look like? This could either be an opportunity or it could be a setback for people who would like to see the installation of more renewable energy in Texas.
I don't know if the answer is building more big plants or whether the answer is something that I've advocated before, which is distributed capacity. In the Permian, we flare enough natural gas to power every home in Texas continuously. And if we would take that natural gas, which is just lit on fire because it's considered a nuisance product in most cases, actually use microgeneration sites to generate electricity there that could be put onto the grid, that would help solve our capacity problems. In fact, it would, I think, eliminate our capacity problems. So I think we have to look at distributed generation. I think we also, it would be a great idea if we could look at homes being more routinely outfitted with solar and batteries, a battery in the home that would have kept us all with our lights and power and our pipes from freezing because we had heat, would have been a great thing in this particular event. That's technologically capable and also financially feasible for many. Those are the things we have to look at to build our capacity.
This is Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm speaking with Krista Castaneda, an energy attorney and engineer, about last week's grid failures and what's being done to keep that from happening again. So are we scapegoating right now, or are we looking for solutions? Are we trying to fix the blame or fix the problem?
I really got a strong sense yesterday that almost everybody there, with the exception of a few representatives, were there to try to get enough information to fix the problem. And that everybody, I really heard very little political posturing yesterday. I'm sure people being people, it will come. But I think we're about trying to fix the problem. And, you know, there may be some that will be intent on assigning blame as well, but what job one is fix the problem.
Is fixing the problem going to involve at least the state of Texas acknowledging that climate change is real and that the state of Texas should at least be doing studies to see what the impact of it is going to be on Texans?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. One thing I heard yesterday that I think goes a little bit towards answering it is the models that are used by ERCOT to ensure reliability, of course, depend on weather. And they talked about how their data in their model was insufficient to model the event that just happened, and that they will be updating the model so that they can predict storms like this and deal with them and the full consequences of them, not just what they had in their model. So if we are actually dealing with the reality of the events that have been going on, which is what I heard ERCOT say yesterday, then we will be moving towards the reality of climate change in our policymaking. Whether or not you'll ever get the Republican administration in Texas to acknowledge it, I don't know, but I think those who actually are responsible for making things go have already figured out there's no avoiding the fact that it's here.
Was this a black swan event, so rare, nothing that we could have actually predicted, but then there it is, and now we're dealing with it? To put all of this money into trying to prevent it from happening again will make us feel better, but not really necessary.
You know, I didn't hear much about the Black Swan event yesterday. What I did hear is that they're simulations, right? So they're a bunch of, you know, technical people running these things, and their simulations of what would happen under these circumstances failed to fully capture what they were dealing with, and that those simulations would be updated. But I think there's plenty being written about how this actually isn't a black swan event, and that the 2011 and more particularly the 1989 events were very similar. So it really drives home the point, you know, third time that this has happened, we have got to fix it. Now the question comes, where's the money going to come from and who's going to be required to comply?
Also the question is, who's making money off of this disaster?
Absolutely. I tweeted yesterday, follow the money. Those who got rich and those who got ruined, that tells us a lot about what we need to know.
So I wonder if we're incentivizing this failure, if we have people who are well entrenched in the legislature with lobbyists and donations to lawmakers who profited big from the scarcity pricing.
Look, I don't know that anybody actually benefited from the scarcity pricing the way the scarcity pricing mechanism is supposed to work, because they weren't physically able to deliver the power. And the other thing that's being talked about is that the PUC could retroactively lift its scarcity pricing order, because it's an artificial thing anyway, right? It didn't have the effect it was supposed to have. There's talk of it being undone. I don't know what the status of that is. again, all of the financial consequences, I do believe, are going to be looked at hard. Who got rich, who got ruined, and changing the incentives. People died. I think that the lawmakers were pretty sober in the face of the fact that people died and people were without power and people suffered for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks going on now. And it can't happen again. And we can't look just to the free market to call the winners and the losers.
So what we had was a failure of the grid due to a weather event. This cold weather hitting Texas rather hard, broadly across the state, lingering for days and days. We do have people who predict the weather. We knew this was coming. We knew a week out that this was coming, an extreme cold weather event was going to grip Texas. We talked about it in our newsroom. We talked about get ready for rolling blackouts. We knew what to expect. I'm wondering about why did they not tell power generators to put off their scheduled maintenance? Why didn't they get ready for this event?
Yeah, we did hear about that yesterday. So everybody knew. Really, even the generators knew. And the question was, how come nobody really told the public what the reality of the situation was? Because it wasn't going to be rolling blackouts. It was going to be, you're going in the dark, we don't know when we're going to get this restarted. And whose responsibility was it to make that information public soon enough? And it may be that we need a whole new public information emergency preparedness agency to, get these kinds of messages out. So on the maintenance front, we heard Energy and Vistra testify yesterday that they did not really have any planned outages going down. There was one equipment failure at one of their plants that they were still dealing with. But by and large, for those companies, their capacity was available during this event had they had the supplies to actually generate the electricity. That wouldn't necessarily be true across the grid. The other part of this is we can't look to just one generation company, right? And one transmission company or an integrated governmental entity that does it all. There are hundreds of these companies, right? So what we heard for some likely isn't true for all. And at the top of it, though, I would say it does seem to me that the ERCOT CEO believes that his job is communications with those entities. So they spend a ton of time, almost like an air traffic controller talking to the planes. They view themselves to be the air traffic controller talking to the generators and the transmission companies. And all up and down the grid, those are the communications that they did engage in. And there was a lot of talk about those communications yesterday.
Mass battery storage is technology that's being developed and used around the world. We see a lot of it in Australia. Why isn't that being talked about?
Yeah, there was a little talk of it yesterday, and it's definitely available. It's just not on our grid right now. One comment was made that it wouldn't have saved us in this event because those batteries would have been drained in 4 hours, even if they had them.
Well, that's if we're using those large scale lithium ion batteries, but there's a lot of ways to create mass battery storage.
Yeah. I mean, battery storage is obviously the way of the future, both, as the home batteries we talked about and even large scale for, utilities, but wasn't there. So something clearly that's got to be looked at. And that's part of the capacity thing, right? You could provide capacity by storing some of the energy.
And also balancing the grid. We heard that Texas was less than 5 minutes away from having a grid systemic failure that would have taken weeks, if not maybe months, to repair. Because if you don't balance the grid, you have fried out components. And so is that scary?
Well, I was terrified yesterday when I heard the CEO of Vistra that owns Comanche Peak, which is our nuclear power plant, say that they were seconds away from the Comanche Peak power plant going down. It's a really bad thing when a nuclear power plant loses electricity, as we know. And the reason for this is because the whole system became completely destabilized when the capacity started dropping off and the load was still the demand was still high. This whole system has to run on a constant 60 hertz frequency, and so the voltage, the frequency dropped to 59.3, I think, which is where you're getting into a range where the equipment at these plants will not accept that frequency and they will shut down, you know, because they've got fail safes built in. And he said they were literally seconds away from that happening there.
If ERCOT had been part of the and fully integrated with national grids, could this whole thing been avoided?
Well, there are places that aren't connected to our grid in Texas. El Paso didn't suffer from this. The Panhandle shares with Oklahoma, and I believe it did not suffer from this quite. I mean, they still had the weather events, obviously, but they didn't have the power events. My understanding of us being separate means that not only are we not connected and able to freely flow power from one place to another, that would have been a benefit to being connected, but we also do not participate in the regulatory oversight that ensures robustness and reliability. And so both of those things would have been good things to have before February 14th.
So should we just, you know, do away with ERCOT or merge ERCOT with these other grids?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. I can see that Texas decides to completely, you know, overhaul its founding concepts for ERCOT and this, you know, independent grid. But Texas being Texas, if I had to bet my political dollars, I'd bet that we still have our own grid.
So people who went through this experience, a harrowing experience, they have had their faith shaken in the system of being able to know that the power will turn on when they need it. How important is it that we find a way to restore that trust?
It's critical to the listeners. You know, let me also say, I am so sorry for the suffering that everybody has had to experience and the freezing cold and the loss of medicines and the boil water. It just has been a catastrophe that we all shared. And one of the things that I think that will come of this is I don't think our political system is going to easily forget this. I think that this is going to be something that drives change in our system. And I'm hopeful that it does. I hope we can look to, you know, a brighter future, literally, because to your point about people needing to be able to trust the electric grid, people will not live in Texas if it's a third world country that can't keep the lights on.
Businesses won't come here.
Companies will not come here. That is absolutely true. You know, when you're a Toyota or a State Farm or any other big company and you're specking out a site, you know, where you're looking to maybe move, you know, one of the first things is infrastructure. Do you have reliable power? Because if you don't, you're not going to move there.
Krista Castaneda is an energy attorney and engineer and former Democratic candidate for Texas Railroad Commission. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters episodes, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.